All righty. If you have your Rose book out, you might want to turn to page 145. Picture of the tabernacle.
I've got the wrong book. Mine is about the tabernacle. Are you on the oversight of it? Okay.
You don't have this book?
I've got that book, but I couldn't find it. So I bought the one that's just completely about the tabernacle.
Oh, okay.
So I've got overlays and things.
Yeah, that's right. Just get the overlay of the big thing. All right. So you can see we're studying the tabernacle in Exodus 26:1, Book of Exodus. And you can see from the picture there the big walled cloth walls all the way around the courtyard there. And in the front part of the courtyard is, you can see the priest offering sacrifice on the altar. And you can see the big container of water where they're trying to clean everything up. By the time you get to the temple, that water, big container of water is as big as a room. And it's being fed by an aqueduct coming in from over the hills. The altar that they're on is raised at that particular point in time. So then to the right of that, you can see this tented area. They've got the top pulled back so you can look into it. And that's the tabernacle. The tented area of the tabernacle is made up of two rooms, the Holy of Holies and the Holy Place. The Holy Place in the front's got the seven-branch candlesticks and the altar of incense, a little square podium-looking thing there. And then there's a curtain that divides that from the Holy of Holies, in which is the Ark of the Covenant. They're trying to show you that the tented materials that are covering the tabernacle are in layers. We talked about that last time. There's porpoise skin and at the very top in order to hold off the water, and there's various layers. And next to closest to the people in the room is this blue and purple cloth that has these pictures of angels on them, etc., etc. Now, all around the outside, you can see that the people of Israel are camped in groups of three tribes each. And those three tribes are always in the same place. And as you read along, one of the things you figure out is that there is an order in which they pick up and go. And then there's an order in which they arrive, etc. So whenever they get ready to move, the people from the east go first, and then the priests step in behind the second tribe. By this time, they've torn everything down. And then when they get to the place where they stop, then they put all this tabernacle back up. And then by the time all the people get there, it's all up and ready to go. The Levites, we talked about before, the tribe were dedicated to the Lord, to the service of the Lord in His house. And in the wilderness, they're pretty much all together. But once we get to the land, of course, they're spread out all over the country. There is a big group of them, though, that are always assigned directly to the tabernacle and then later to the temple. And these people, by families, are given assignments, things like this family tears down the wall, this family tears down the tabernacle itself, and this family, and they haul this. It's like ants. They just all pick up their pieces and go somewhere, and when they get there, they all put them back together. There's a family that, there's groups of people that carry the altar of incense and the bread of presence and the branch candlesticks and, of course, the Ark of the Covenant. You can see those carry poles sticking out and all that stuff there because that's how they carried it. We're on page 74, at least I am. I don't know what you all are on, but page 74, Exodus 26, verse 1. Yeah?
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Do you think there's, what significance is there at, you know, the end when there's going to be a millennial temple?
Yeah.
and there's going to be the tribes around?
Yes.
Right? But they're different configurations.
Well, first of all, in the millennial reign, the tribes are not configured around it. Tribes are configured in striated levels. And the area that's dedicated to the prince, the human king, and to the temple and the Levites, Kohathite Levites, that's a strip down the middle. So there's about five tribes striated below that, and about seven tribes striated above that. So it's not in the same configuration at all. It's not even the same configuration as when they came into the land, because you remember that in the land there was three tribes that were over on the east side of the Jordan, but once we get to the millennial reign, these people will be, there'll be some people east of the Jordan at the very top, but the vast majority of what was Moab and all that will not be inhabited anymore by the Israelites. They'll all be west of the Jordan, and they'll be in Mishraishan from the brook of Egypt all the way up to the Mount Hermon. So, that is your question.
Sure.
All right then.
Go ahead.
This is what we talk about at dinner.
We actually do.
I love it.
Pass the peas and please explain to me the tribe of Judah.
Why was the ark so important then and not today?
Well, the presence of the Lord is now in us instead of in a place. The Ark of the Covenant was basically the throne or the resting place of God among the people. And when God left the people, the Ark went away and has never yet returned, although it will, has never yet returned. And because after Jesus came, then we became the Ark of the Covenant. All the believers become the Ark of the Covenant. The Lord is now resting in us instead of there. But in the millennial reign, the millennial temple will be set up as of old, and God will rest over the Ark of the Covenant. Jesus will lodge in the city brought down from heaven, the Jerusalem brought down from heaven. But that's another lesson, another study. Yeah. All right. Well, Exodus 26, verse 1. Moreover, you shall make the tabernacle with 10 curtains of fine twisted linen, and blue and purple and scarlet material. And you shall make them with cherubim, the work of skillful workmen. And the length of each curtain shall be 28 cubits, and the width of each curtain shall be 4 cubits. And all the curtains shall have all the same measurements. So 5 curtains shall be joined to one another, and the other 5 curtains shall be joined to one another. And you shall make loops of blue on the edge of the outermost curtain of the first set. Likewise, you shall make them on the edge of the curtains, the outermost of the second set. You shall make 50 loops in one curtain, and you shall make 50 loops on the edge of the curtain, so that it is in the second set, and the loops shall be opposite each other. You shall make 50 clasps of gold, and join the curtains to one another with clasps, that the tabernacle may have a unit. So what you're looking at there is all of these curtains around the tabernacle, and the measurements and how they're put together, not to be confused with that around the courtyard. So the curtains were constructed with the same material as the ceiling, blue, purple, and scarlet linen with cherubim designs on it. I think we get a good look at that on the next page over, page 147. You can get a kind of look at the material, followed by the goat hair, followed by the ram skin dyed red, followed by the sea cow hides. Y'all seeing that? So that kind of shows you, and then you can see the walls of curtains all the way around there and how they're joined together.
The detail's amazing.
Yeah.
Wayne, yeah. When Christ died and the curtain was torn.
Yeah, that curtain is the one that's between the Holy of Holies and the Holy Place.
Gotcha.
And that curtain was there to protect God's holiness.
Okay.
It was a separation, it was a barrier.
Okay.
Once Jesus died and took the penalty of our sin upon us, then we began to have access to God. I mean, you have to realize that we have better access to God today as an unbeliever.
Mm-hmm.
Seeking and praying to God than the Jews did during their day. We don't realize it's hard. You know, you're used to living in a world where everything is like it is, it's been like it is all your life, and you assume, number one, it's like that everywhere. Of course, it's not. And you assume, number two, it's always been like that. And of course, it's not. We have so much more going for us than these people did, you know. And when you look sometimes or you read about what they've done and some of the sin and things that are going on, we think, wow, those people were really wicked people. They had no Holy Ghost, you know, to mediate against all that sort of thing. So, you know, we actually don't come across so good when you realize what all we've got going for us. Then you shall make curtains of goat's hair for a tent over the tabernacle. You shall make 11 curtains in all. The length of each curtain shall be 30 cubits, and the width of each curtain 4 cubits. 11 curtains shall have the same measurement. You shall join 5 curtains by themselves. Another 6 curtains by themselves. You shall double over the 6th curtain at the front of the tent. You shall make 50 loops on the edge of the curtain so that it's outermost in the first set. 50 loops on the edge of the curtain so that it is outermost in the second set. You shall make 50 clasps of bronze. You shall put the clasp in the loops. Join the tents together that it may be a unit, and the overlapping part that is left over in the curtains of the tent, the half curtain that is left over, shall lap over the back of the tabernacle, and the curtain on that on one side and the curtain on the other side, what is left over in the length of the curtains of the tent, shall lap over the sides of the tabernacle on one side and on the other side. You shall make a covering for the tent of ram skin dyed red, and covering of porpoise skins above. So once again, if you go to page 147, you get a good look at that those layers and the curtains that are that thing makes up. Okay. So this is the description of the ceiling or the roofing of the tabernacle portion. So then you shall take the boards for the tabernacle of acacia wood and spring standing upright. 10 cubits shall be the length of each board, and 1.5 cubits the width of each board. And there shall be 2 tenons for each board fitted to one another. Thus you do for all the boards of the tabernacle. And you shall make the boards for the tabernacle 20 boards for the south side. And you shall make 40 sockets of silver under the 20 boards, 2 sockets, one for under one board for its 2 tenons, and 2 sockets under the other board for its 2 tenons. For the second side of the tabernacle on the north side, 20 boards. There are 40 sockets of silver, 2 sockets under one board, and 2 sockets under another board. And for the rear of the tabernacle to the west, you shall make 6 boards. You shall take make 2 boards for the corners of the tabernacle at the rear, and they shall be a double beneath, and they together they shall be complete to its top. To the first ring, and they shall be with both of them, and they shall form the 2 corners. And there shall be 8 boards with their sockets of silver, and 16 sockets, 2 sockets under one board, and 2 sockets on another board. And you shall make bars of acacia wood, 5 for the boards on one side of the tabernacle, and 5 bars for the boards on the other side of the tabernacle, and 5 bars for the boards on the side of the tabernacle for the rear of the side of the tabernacle. And the middle bar in the center of the board shall pass through the from end to end. You shall overlay the boards with gold and make their rings of gold as holders for the bars, and shall overlay the bars with gold. Then you shall erect the tabernacle according to its plan. So this is the description of the supporting planks of the tabernacle. And if you can kind of see it on 145 by looking into it, but you can see it better on page 147 with all of its design by looking at the wooden structure. So this is like a huge big erector set or Lincoln logs. And what they did was they had to make these things specification. I once went to a place called New Harmony, Indiana. And New Harmony, Indiana was a site that was built by a bunch of people who were looking for a New Jerusalem, build a New Jerusalem. It was a Father George Raft was the head of the pastor of this particular group. And they all migrated down from Illinois, Ohio, or some such place looking for, it came down the Wabash, and they formed this community in New Harmony, Indiana. New Harmony, Indiana is best known for being the watermelon capital of the world, right outside of Posey, Indiana. And when you come into this town, we visited some people who were there. It was a pastor. And these people, when they would come down the river, they first sent their workmen ahead of them. And these guys felled logs and shaped these logs and put Roman numerals on each one of these logs and stacked them. And when a person would come in, they'd get a house. And so they would erect one. So we were sitting in the pastor's dining room looking up at these walls, and you can see the Roman numerals all across the logs as they go by, because this was one of the original houses. Now, since then, everybody's added on wings and stuff to it. So what you mostly had was that was still standing, except for a couple of things that were just exhibits, were people who were living in houses that had at their core one of these old houses, and then other things had been built on. New Harmony, Indiana was a failed community after a while. The people there were not able to create the New Jerusalem that they wanted. And they sold New Harmony to a group of intellectuals back in the, I guess it was 1840s, something like that. They sold it to this group of intellectuals who brought this whole big group down the Wabash River on a big boat, and they called it the Boatload of Knowledge, because these were all a bunch of eggheads who thought they were going to create this new utopia. Well, what happened is when they got there, what they found out is everybody wanted to think and nobody wanted to work. They built this huge Athenaeum, which is a center of learning dedicated to Athena, and it still stands. It's a big white edifice. It's startling. You're out in the middle of an area that looks like some frontier town with some modern, you know, clapboard and stuff on some houses and whatever. And you pull, and there, all of a sudden there's this huge white marble Athenaeum, and you go inside, and there's all of this exhibits to all the brilliant people who once lived here. There is a huge statue, and I forget which one of the philosophers it was, that they have there in the town, that's dedicated to this Chardin or somebody like that, Taylor de Chardin or something like that, dedicated to him. And what's interesting is if for some reason unknown to man, the local birds have made it the depository of their scat. And so Chardin's nose is about up to here with a mountain of poop just goes all the way down. It's almost like God sent all the birds to tell him what he thought of this. And the people who bought the town turned the church into a house for selling livestock. So they were selling and slaughtering hogs in their church. So the people came back and bought the church and tore it down and used it to build a wall around their graveyard of their saints, their dead people. But eventually the whole thing went away because of an infestation of mosquitoes on the Wabash River that made it just so impossible to live there that people just up and went away. But it is an interesting place when you go there. New Harmony, Indiana, you drive in and they offer you a kind of a bit of a tour, you know, if you want to see one. But it's just a study. And there's a couple of hotels there, and all the furniture and everything is period from the 1830s, 1840s. Beautiful hotel rooms, B&B type places. It's got modern stuff, furnishings around it. But it's all furnished out, and it's just as beautiful as it can be. Of course, you're doing this constantly, you know, whatever. Between the birds and the mosquitoes, it's just like a living hell. So God's having fun with them. So
I was thinking when Moses got
Revelation. Yeah. Well, what brought me to think New Harmony is that all of these buildings were numbered. The logs on all these buildings were numbered with Roman numerals. So, and they were all cut and built exactly to spec. So when the people, and this is in the 1830s, when the people came down the river, they would go to the local kind of a store there, and they would be assigned a house. This was one of those communities where everybody was sharing with everything in common. And they would be assigned a house. And the local men would take this house, put it on wagons, go over there and install it. And, of course, one looked just like the other, just looked like the other, just like the other. Well, these people here had the same issue. They had to, here in the Bible, they had to build all these pieces exactly to specification so that they could be assembled in such a way that everywhere they went, it would be an intact whole. And, of course, they would have to be numbered in order so that people would know what went together, kind of like Lincoln logs, like I said. But these things were totally torn down and moved every time they moved for the 40 years that they were in the desert and for another, Judges is 1335 to another 300 and some odd years in Israel, because the tabernacle was there until the temple was built. The temple was built somewhere close to 950 or so. So 300-400 years in there. It was the job of the Levites to do this. So you think about cathedrals that were made by 7 or 8 or 10 generations of family, you know, in Europe with the guilds and everything. You know, your father worked on the cathedral, and your grandfather worked on the cathedral, and you worked on the cathedral, and your son would work on the cathedral. That's the way these Levites did. They had people who, for generation after generation after generation, they carried this particular part of the tabernacle on their shoulders and reassembled it and took it down every time they got ready to move. Psalm 69 talks about the process of moving the camp, and they would come and they would blow the ram's horn, and the Hussein, or the person who was would be shouting out the orders, would say, "Let God arise, let his enemies be scattered, let him be like wax before," whatever. It's Psalm 69, you can read it. And what happened is that would get passed down to all the various people. And then Psalm 69. And then the people would all go about their business, and the kids would all start grabbing up all the various things they were assigned to grab up, and mom and dad would put together their tent and whatever and pack it all up, and if they had beasts, they'd go out getting their beasts and put them in, whatever they had to do. And meanwhile, the Levites would come in and start tearing everything down, put it all, you know, whatever. And then at some particular point in time, they and so out would go the tribe of the east, it's the west. Issachar, Judah, followed by the priests, and then Zebulun, and then all these tribes would fall in order. And they would go, and they would go, and sometimes they would travel for weeks, and then all of a sudden they would tell people, "We're going to stop," and boom, everything would go back up, and all the tents would come out and around all the four sides, and people would, you know, you live next to the Johnsons all your life, and the Johnsons were like, you know, 15 and a half feet from their tent, from your tent, and whatever. You knew what I was going over there, what they were having for supper, and a whole bunch of other things you didn't want to know. But that's the way this community migrated. And
did they carry hot coals with them?
Mm-hmm. They carried the process of, they're called braziers. The process of carrying braziers, these were also on poles, and they've got these hot coals and these bronze pans, you know. They're just walking along. They got lids on them and everything. The suckers are smoking, and they get a little breeze up, you know. And it's one of the reasons why they had so much incense. Was because make sure that everything was sweet smelling. It beat bathing, you know. I mean, trying to bathe 2 million people with. Yeah, that's right. So.
Question: do we know how many times the tabernacle was moved, and was it only moved when God said to move it?
Tabernacle was only moved when God told them to, because if they moved it when God didn't tell them to, they'd all die. I mean, it was just that simple. But actually, there's somewhere, I don't know if it's in here or in one of the other books. It might be in in the book of Numbers, I think it is. They talk about the stages in the wilderness, and there was about 50 of them. I can't remember the exact number, but when we study whatever that is, there's a place where it lists the stages, and I number each stage as it goes. And it seems like to me it was about 50 stages or so. Maybe I'm just guessing now. And then, of course, once it got into the land, it went. You can kind of follow it because it went kind of wherever Joshua was, and it was at Bethel a lot. Bethel, and it was at Shechem some, and various places, you know, where they were.
When on 155, it talks about the journey of the ark, but it doesn't really say, it says a lot of the different things, but it doesn't say how many times in the 4 years.
That just gives you the overall journey of the ark. But
you said it was, they used the tabernacle for 300 some years. Right?
Well, the tabernacle. It just all depends on your dating scheme, but if you use 1450 as Sinai, okay, then you know. Let's see. I think the period of the judges is 1365 to 1000 when David becomes king. So for that 365 years, there's no temple, so there's a tabernacle, and then the period between 1450 and 365 is the period of the transition and all of that, you know, coming in. And then you've got the period during David's life. So the temple's built about 950. So the tabernacle is in use all the way up to 950 BC from about 1400 BC. Something of that nature. Dating in the Old Testament is...
That's on the, you know, 500 years.
Yeah, 400 and plus the wilderness. So,
they moved it on average every 100 years.
Oh, no. They moved every month.
Every 10 years. Well, didn't you say it was just moved 50 times?
In the wilderness.
Just in the wilderness.
Yeah. Now, and I said 50 from my memory. Yeah, if I had my book, I think it's in Numbers.
I mean, it's got to be a hard thing to do. I was just trying to get my mind around.
No, actually, in the book of Numbers, it gives you the stages. And when I did that, I actually numbered them. I just can't remember tonight what they were, but it was 50 or more in 40 years. And you know, they might, for instance, and the thing is that they might move the tabernacle and walk 10 days, okay, and then they might stop and settle it down. And they might sit there for 3 months. So, and speaking of production, if you've ever been around the production of a play, you've got all these ants running around, moving proscenium around, curtains and all this kind of stuff, and only this is on a much larger scale. All right, verse 31. You shall make a veil of blue and purple and scarlet material and fine twisted linen. It shall be made with cherubim, the work of skilled workmen. And you can see that veil fairly good there on page 145. This is the veil between the two. You can get a better look at it really on page 147. And you shall hang it on four pillars of acacia overlaid with gold, their hooks also being of gold, on four sockets of silver. And you shall hang it on the veil under the clasp, and you shall bring in the ark of the testimony there within the veil, and the veil shall serve for you as a partition between the holy place and the holy of holies. So you can see how that works in your picture. You can see the ark of the covenant there. You shall put the mercy seat on the ark of the testimony in the holy of holies. You shall set the table outside the veil and the lampstand opposite the table. So, let's see, you can see that there. And you shall put the table on the north side, and of course the lampstand on the south side. You shall make a screen for the doorway of the tent of blue and purple and scarlet material and fine twisted linen, the work of a weaver. You shall make five pillars of acacia for the screen, overlaid with gold, and their hooks also being gold, and you shall cast five sockets of bronze for them. So they basically told you about how to build the veil there and set up the holy place in the Holy of Holies. Now, let's see. I'm pretty sure it's in the book of Numbers. What we're getting here is a summary. The real detail is in the book of Numbers. It's much more detailed than this. And one of the things that they tell you at the early part of the book of Numbers is that God appointed two men, Bezalel and Aholiab, and infused them with supernatural understanding for how to build and how to make things and whatever, so that they had this extraordinary gifting. So Bezalel and Aholiab are kind of metaphors for people who are particularly brilliant. So we had this one couple in our church, and Charlie was this guy. He could build anything in the whole world. He could make anything. We always had these. We spent a lot of our weekends fixing up each other's houses because we were all Poe's church mice and we couldn't afford it, but we all jumped in and pitched in each other's houses. And in fact, we'd raise money to buy the wallpaper, or we'd rebuild a foundation under a house, or add a room on, or whatever. We did all this kind of stuff ourselves, and Charlie usually led all the projects because he could do the electrical, he could do the plumbing, he could do any of it, and he'd do it according to his code and the whole nine yards. And his wife was at least as talented as he was. She used to make his suits for him. So, and in fact, she made Ben and I, Todd and I, matching suits one time, so that we could walk around looking like each other. So we called them Bezalel and Aholiab because they were so skilled at what they did. But
they loved that thing.
Oh, they were humble people. They just mostly grinned and kept on going.
Yeah.
But
these wonderful devices here says that during the Israelite sojourn in the wilderness, tabernacle was moved 42 times. That's in the wilderness. That's Numbers chapter 33.
Okay, that's Numbers. That's where it is. So I said 50. I was guessing.
You're close.
That's close.
Yeah. Well, I knew it was somewhere around there. Mm-hmm. Just guessing. But Numbers 33, if you read it, it gives you the stages. And actually, when you study it, you come up with several different numbers. Because some stages are counted twice. Some stages are so anyway, it's in the neighborhood of 40, 45, I mean 42 to 45, 48, some of that nature. But I cover all that in the numbers thing.
Yeah.
I do have one question too. About, I tried to look mine up too earlier, but I wanted to pay attention to this too. The acacia wood, what was the significance of that?
Acacia? Yeah. Acacia was a hard, dark wood that would stand up over time.
Okay.
And of course, and they would overlay it. But my impression of acacia wood is that it was hard and dark. It was a hard wood, and that it had a dark...
It was reddish, too.
Was it reddish?
Yeah, it looks kind of like that. Yeah, I'll look it up.
Okay. Well, that would be dark to me, but yeah, okay, like the iced tea.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I guess. I'm not great on woods. Mahogany, I suppose, would be.
Yeah, like cherry.
Was that used in Noah's Ark or
cherry wood? Yeah.
No, gopher wood wasn't it used.
Gopher was what Noah used.
It was what Noah used.
Yeah.
But it'd be strong for making those poles.
Yeah.
That's the main thing.
Well, yeah, I mean, you have to think about that. They had to use ingredients that would... I mean, when God was telling them to make them, he wasn't they weren't going to use it for tailgating for a weekend, you know.
Yeah.
This was a big tailgate.
Big tailgate, yeah.
And it lasted a long, long time. It's interesting that once they get to the temple, they move to wood like cedar, which is not near as strong, but smells real good, and it was highly valued. They floated a forest. From Tyre and Sidon, and brought it over on wagons to fill the temple full of cedar. And in the references to that time period, including in the prophets who spoke against them, like Haggai, who spoke against the people because they were living in paneled houses while the Lord was living in a tent. Or they were living in paneled houses. There's a phrase that comes up a lot among the prophets called paneled houses. And that's what they mean. They mean houses, the walls of which were covered in cedar panels. And so what happens, people were living high on the hog, and their neighbor was starving. It's kind of like today, yeah. McMansions, I called them, you know. They could have been called McMansions today. All righty.
I was thinking about how detailed God was in putting all this together, and then I remembered, guess what? He made a human body.
Yeah.
Could be much more detailed than that.
Yeah.
This was simple.
He probably called this slipshod work, you know.
Yeah. It's amazing. I mean, to read this stuff, how everything fit together just perfectly, and they were able to follow his directions and do it.
Yeah, well, as long as they did, yeah. And, what happens when we don't follow his directions? It looks like a monstrosity, whatever it is we do, including our lives sometimes. All right, page 76, Exodus 27. God gives Moses specific instructions for the construction of the tabernacle. I've read some of this before. This is the summary, and I've read it earlier because the details for a lot of this stuff is all up inside... Inside of here, and so I put it together in a summary so you get an overview of it. And it goes like this. God gives Moses specific instructions for the construction of the tabernacle. The tabernacle was a tent-like structure that functioned as a portable temple for Israel until Solomon built the first permanent temple in Jerusalem. Its materials and structure were complex and very specific. It replaced the temporary tent of meeting first used by God as the place of contact between himself and Israel's leaders. So when they first got to Sinai, and on the way to Sinai, they had a tent that they had set aside for meeting with God. And that was called the Tent of Meeting. Once the tabernacle was built, it replaced the Tent of Meeting. Up until the tabernacle was built, remember, the Shekinah glory would come down and hover over the Tent of Meeting whenever God wanted to visit with them. So I've been through this next section before with you all, so I'm going to skip it if I can and move on to the text. Is that all right? Because we covered it before, and it's the same summary we had before. And all the way up to including where each of the tribes lived, east, west, north, and south. So now I'm on page 27, page 77, verse 27. Is it 78 on y'all's books?
What? Yeah, 76.
76 on your book, verse 27. You find it there, Raymond?
Chapter 10.
You got it? Are you copacetic? Okay. All right. You shall make an altar of acacia wood, 5 cubits long, 5 cubits wide, and the altar shall be square, and the height of it shall be 3 cubits. Now, we're talking about the burnt offering, the altar for burnt offerings, which is in the courtyard here, down on the left in your big picture. You shall make its horns on its 4 corners. Its horns shall be 1 piece with it, and you shall overlay it with bronze. Several times in the scripture, it talks about men coming up and clinging to the horns of the altar for sanctuary. And that is that's what the horns of the altar are whenever you see that. The prophet Zechariah was slain by the evil king, I forget which one it was at this point, while he was holding onto the horns of the altar, which is normally a place of sanctuary. And they slew him there. At one particular point in time, I think Jesus says, "You've killed the prophets and the holy men from Abel to Zechariah, A to Z, so to speak." And that's Zechariah that was spoken of there. He's the son of Berechiah, not the other one. Also, it was at the horns of the altar that Joab ran and hid from Solomon. He hung on to the horns of the altar. Solomon had him killed anyway. But several other times you'll see that. But that's what the horns of the altar are. Altars frequently had horns like this. Horns throughout the Bible are used as symbols for power and authority. For instance, we talk about the mark of the beast, or the beast having 10 horns and 3 of them are overcome by a smaller horn. The concept of horns is always used as a metaphorical, or often used as a metaphorical thing for strength or power or ability, authority. You shall make it you shall make its pails for removing its ashes, and its shovels and its basins with its forks and fire pans, and you shall make all its utensils of bronze. So, Bob, you think you got a task putting together a barbecue. These guys have got a big one here, and they're going to have pails for getting rid of all these ashes, and shovels and stuff to fill them up with. And so he's giving them instructions on how to make their barbecue tools, you know. You shall make for it a grating of network of bronze. And you can see the grating on the top there if you look at it. It may be a better look somewhere else. Let me see here. Well, you can get a little bit of a look at it on page 148.
151 in the middle.
Yeah, 151 in the middle has got a look at it, although it doesn't look square there. So, at any rate, yeah. So, by the way, that's a pretty good piece there on the various offerings, Mount Leviticus. There's 5 types of offerings that were offered to the Lord. And you can see that the piece of fellowship offering, they present it as a meal, a potluck dinner. You can also see that the grain offering there is bread, either as wafers or loaf or grits. The Bible says, and with that was drunk wine. So we get the bread and wine, you know, from that. I'm digressing, but at any rate, back to our text here, verse 4. You shall make a grating of a network of bronze, and on the net You shall place four bronze rings at its four corners, and you shall put it beneath and under the ledge of the altar, that the net may reach halfway up the altar, and you shall make poles for the altar, poles of acacia wood, and overlay them with bronze, and its poles shall be inserted in the rings. So the poles shall be on two sides of the altar when it is carried. All of these. Back to page 44, again, is a probably good look there. Let's see here. Where am I? Okay. You shall make it hollow with planks as it was shown to you in the mountain. So you shall make it. So what they've got here is a wooden altar lined with bronze, and then the offering is done inside of the bronze fire pan, as it were. And then, of course, the thing is moved around. And when they got to... I won't get to that right now. All right, Roman number 2. The altar for burnt offering was located nearest the door of the courtyard. It was the farthest away from the holy place for the very simple reason that you don't want to stink the place up next to the holy place. Even though there was a fragrant offering because the wood meat was being cooked, and remember they were instructed when they would kill the meat, that if it was an immolation, the burnt offering, which is one of the five offerings, it was totally consumed in fire. Horns, hoods, skin, everything. But four of the five were not immolations. They were partial immolations, but the rest of it made for people's food to eat. Celebrations, for instance. So you would have the hooves and the horns and the fat would be offered to God. The skins would be given to the priest. The right shoulder and breast of the animal would be given to the priest as their portion, and the rest of it would be cut, cooked, packaged, and given to people for their celebratory meals and whatever.
This time, was the priest the only ones who went inside?
The priests were the only people inside of this courtyard. Yeah, outside of this would be what in the temple became known as the courtyard of the women and the courtyard of the Gentiles, but the priests were the only people allowed inside of this courtyard, the priests and the Levites, because that was their place of work.
So when they started taking it down, did they have to take the courtyard fence down and then the people would start?
The impression I have is that as the people would come to this place, they would walk around it. That's just the impression that I have. Once it's all taken down and everything, it's sort of neutral ground. But you have I've seen like pictures or movies, and the people would get there and they would walk around it. That's only an impression I have.
They were not light.
No, that's why they've got two carry poles with four to six men on each one.
And I didn't think the priests would be doing that. So.
Oh no, that's exactly what the Levites did. The Levitical tribe was divided into the family of Moses, the family of Aaron, were the priests. All other Levites were Levites. And the priests did the sacrificing. All other Levites did all the carry and clean and all that stuff. The reason why he says here that this altar has to be the farthest away from the Holy of Holies is not because of the nice fragrant smell you get when you cook this meat. It's because of the really bad smell you get when you kill this and the animal dumps everything right there at its feet as it dies. And a priest coming home from work at night. When I was a young man, I used to work at a donut shop. And I got to where I would smell so much like donuts that my wife made me take off my clothes in the yard and come into the house.
Oh, my goodness.
You think I'm kidding, but I'm not.
Did they have videos back then?
So
she wouldn't let me bring my clothes in, you know, or whatever, and you know the shoes and everything I wore, because you know we'd make donuts all night long, and then you know we'd clean it all up. I mean, by the time I got done making donuts, the kitchen was spotless. But I took like a dough knife, and I would scrape all the tables, and I'd scrape the floor and everything else. But all that sugar and grease and oils and stuff would just get all over the place, and they would just and the smell of it would permeate your clothes. I mean, I got to where I couldn't eat a donut for 25, 30 years. I mean, seriously, it's only been in recent years that I've been able to tolerate a donut without throwing up. Because the smell of it just permeates your clothes. You're talking about the Pillsbury Doughboy, you know. But she wouldn't let me come in. And I have to take my clothes off and dump them in a big thing out there. And then she would just take them directly to wash them and whatever. And even washed, they would still smell, you know, like the... So
the priest had some of that problem, too.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure when they came home at night. Of course, you know, who knows? And these people, their idea of hygiene. But when they would come home at night, they would be covered in everything imaginable. From top to bottom, splatter, and all that sort of thing.
Maybe they bathed in the river, but not in the desert.
Well, you know, there were times when water like that was prevalent, and there were times when it was not. So, you know, listen, you can go forward into history up until the 1900s in our own country and find people who didn't bathe but once a month or less. So you have to think about what people put up with and got used to in terms of just smell and all of that sort of thing. So
some of the Middle Eastern countries are still...
Yeah, in fact, one of the practices that the pioneers used was to bathe in sand. If they had a big sandy place, they would just take sand and wipe themselves off. I mean, they stripped down and bathed in sand because it would just... It was really helpful. They'd just get a lot of stuff off, and sand would absorb and whatever, and they'd shake off the sand and whatever, and they were ready for mama. You know, they were in pretty good shape. So, moving on. I think I'm on Roman numeral 2D here. So it was made of acacia wood planks covered in bronze. It was 7.5 feet square by 4.5 feet tall and hollow in the center. It will have bronze rings and bronze covered acacia poles. The utensils used in the sacrifices were also bronze. These included ash pails, shovels, basins, forks, and fire pans.
They had to do some mining back then.
Yeah, they had to... Yeah, they had to find the materials for this. One of the things that that happened, remember, was as they came out of Egypt, they were given a great deal of wealth by the Egyptians. Remember, God put a spirit upon the Egyptians, and they just dumped a bunch of wealth on them. Well, a lot of this kind of stuff was donated back from the families that got all this. Earlier in Numbers, we get that picture of those people voluntarily donating back this stuff. For the, you know, fashioning. I mean, they had stacks and stacks of gold, stacks and stacks of silver, and anything was valuable, jewels and stuff like that. All right, verse 9. You shall make the court of the tabernacle. So here he's describing a description of the courtyard, its walls, and its pillars. You shall make the court of the tabernacle. On the south side there should be hangings for the court of fire-twisted linen, 100 cubits long for one side, and its pillars shall be 20, with their 20 sockets of bronze, and the hooks of the pillars and their bands shall be of silver. Now we're talking about this big tented wall around there. You see that? That's what he's talking about. Likewise, for the north side in length there shall be hangings 100 cubits long and its 20 pillars. There are 20 sockets of bronze and the hooks of pillars and their bands shall be of silver. For the width of the court on the west shall be hangings of 50 cubits and there are 10 pillars and 10 sockets. That's the section behind the tabernacle there. And if you look on page 144 and 145, they'll give you the east, west, north, and south if you look at where the tribes are coming from. Okay. You have page 144 and 145. See where the tribes are? Look at the bottom of the page on the right. Tribe of Dan, north. Tribe of Asher, north.
Oh, I see.
Okay. So there's north and there's south, and then west is always behind the tabernacle, and east is always, the eastern gate is always coming, approaching the tabernacle in the front. That's true of the temple in Israel still today. And Ezekiel's temple is the same way. Ezekiel's temple. So you can, I think they did this scale. Let me see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I can count that. I think there's 20 there. I think they did it to scale.
Is there any significance of which tribe was on what wall?
Not that I know of. I know of no reason why they were chosen to do that. The eastern tribe took off first, and that was Issachar, Judah, and Zebulun, and there's no rhyme or reason to that. The families of Moses and Aaron were in one group there. And then you see around the other three sides, the three tribes of the Levites, the Merarites, the Gershonites, and the Kohathites. You see those people there? So that's where the Levites are living, close to the tabernacle. And the priests, which is Moses plus Aaron's family, are all living here on the east. See? This is a good little book, just to give you... these things are so hard to envision. If, first of all, it's not been part of your culture, and you know, and this it just helps me to get my mind around all these details and whatever. All righty, that's how about verse 12? For the width of the court on the west shall be hangings of 50 cubits, for there are 10 pillars, 10 sockets, and the width of the court on the east shall be 50 cubits. Remember, a cubit is 18 inches or a foot and a half. A cubit. There's two types of cubits, but the normal cubit is the length of a man's wrist to his elbow, which was roughly 18 inches. The hangings for one side of the gate shall be 15 cubits, with their three pillars and three sockets, and for the other side will be 15 cubits, and their three pillars and three sockets. Verse 16, this is the screen that functions as the gate to the courtyard. Here is a description. For the gate of the court, there should be a screen 20 cubits of blue and purple and scarlet material and fine twisted linen. Now, if you look at this screen here that you see down here, this screen actually, at least in the temple, I know, stands back. There's a, and I don't know if they're trying to show that here or not, but you actually go around this thing in order to come in. So it's stands back. Let me look and see.
So it was actually open?
When, as you can tell, on the top of 147.
147. Yeah, that's it. The top of 147 is a really good example. You see how the screen there on the right-hand side stands away from the rest of it. So there was a set of measurements there where they were on the eastern side, where instead of having 50 cubits solid worth of material, they had 15 and 15. So giving you 30, and then you had this thing here. So that's how that works. So it's fine twisted, the work of a weaver, with their four pillars and their four sockets, and the pillars around the court shall be furnished with silver bands, silver hooks, and their sockets of bronze. The length of the court shall be 100 cubits, and the width 50 throughout, and the height 5 cubits of twisted linens, and their sockets of bronze. All the utensils of the tabernacle used in all its service, all its pegs, all the pegs of the court shall be bronze. Now, one thing we can notice is the closer you are to the Holy of Holies, the more gold you see. And the way from the Holy of Holies, it moves to silver and bronze. And if it has to be durable, it's bronze. If you've ever, you know for your own experience, if you ever tried to stick a gold shovel into the altar, you'd come out with nothing. It would just melt. So it had to be bronze. So this screen functions as a gate to the courtyard. It is forward of the opening on the eastern wall, so that you had to walk around the sides into the courtyard. It's 30 feet wide and made of the same wall construction. Okay, and then verse 20, you shall charge the sons of Israel that they bring clear oil of beaten olives for the light to make a lamp burn continually in the tent of meeting and outside the veil which is before the testimony. And Aaron and his sons shall keep it in order from evening to morning before the Lord. And it shall be a perpetual statute throughout their generations for the sons of Israel. So a brief mention here is made of the oil for the lamps and the Levite responsibilities. If you go back to Leviticus, there's actually a formula for this oil. And this oil had to be made exactly a certain way. And it took 8 days to make consecrated oil. At the time when they were to... the time of Antiochus Epiphanes, 167 B.C., you remember he desecrated the temple by putting in the statue of Zeus and slaughtering hogs. And the temple was desecrated for 1,150 days which caused the cessation of morning and evening sacrifices, 2,300 of them. At the end of that time frame, the Maccabees ran them out, and they rededicated the temple, and when they got ready to bring the oil in for the lamps, they only had one vial of oil, and so they had to make new oil, and that took 8 days. And during that 8-day period, the one vial of oil held on. That is the Feast of Hanukkah to the Jews. That is the Feast of Lights. The fact that God miraculously provided a vial of oil that lasted 8 days longer than it should have while it was being prepared. That Hanukkah is like their Christmas. Presents are given and God's provision is... it's kind of the Jewish Santa Claus, you know. So, well, St. Nicholas, or Santa Claus as we often call him, is a metaphor for God's grace and giving. That's how it started, as a metaphor for God's generosity and grace towards us. And the Jews experienced that as a feast in the Feast of Hanukkah, which is a low feast for the Jews, but it's a feast nonetheless. All right, Exodus 28, verse 1, page 79 or 78 on your book, I guess. All right, this is going to be another one of those summaries, but this one's not one we've had before. The garments of the high priest are designed for symbolism, constructed with the highest materials with great care, and they are worn as follows. Now, on page 145, you get a picture of the high priest's garments all in one place, and it seems to me somewhere... I thought there was a... Well, there's a legend there, so... Ah, let's see here. That legend... Okay, on page 150, there's another picture of it. Let me see something here. Okay, I know where it is. All right, so on 145, where you see the high priest, if you go to 146, Roman numeral 2... is the details of the legend for that high, for the garments of the high priest. So if you go over to Roman page 146, Roman numeral 2, that one block is the details there. First was a linen tunic worn that hung to the tops of the feet. So if you look at the high priest there, you'll see that there is a tunic sticking out from the bottom of that skirt that he's wearing there, made of pure linen. Second was a blue linen robe that hung down about a foot above the feet. That's what 2B is supposed to be there. It was decorated at the bottom with golden bells and pomegranates. Now, you remember why it had bells on it? Because if he fell over dead in the when he was in there ministering in the Holy of Holies, they couldn't go in and get him. So they listened for him, make sure he was still alive. They would throw meat hooks in and pull him out if he fell over. They had to know where to throw the meat hooks in, so they had to... So, it was heavily embroidered so that it would not tear or fray. Now, one of the things we see a lot, and of course we're reading this in Deuteronomy, which is a snapshot. When we go to Leviticus and Numbers and read these things, there's much more detail. But one of the principles is that nothing comes before the Lord that's not absolutely spot on and absolutely perfectly done, high end, very expensive, top of the line. Because God is trying to make the impression that He is a holy God set apart to them to be honored above all other things. We have, in the Western Christian church, reduce God to our servant or our equal. We negotiate with Him as if we're equals, or we fuss at Him because He doesn't serve us as well as we thought He should. You know, my stock went down yesterday. Bad guy, you know. And we fuss at Him for His poor service. The Jews understood an attitude of latitude and gratitude, that God is above them. Hear, O Israel, the Lord thy God is one. It doesn't mean that He is monotheistic. It means He is first. He's first above all things. Numero uno is what that means. So everything that has to do with, that comes before the Lord, has to be top of the line. All right, so this linen robe resembled a southwestern poncho in how it fit over over top there. The third was an ephod or a waistcoat that hung about 2 feet above the knees. That's that 2C, well actually, yeah, 2C. 2C is also pointing to the sash, but you can see the waistcoat there. It's in your picture. A sash or a girdle was worn around the waist to hold it close. So 2C there shows you both the sash and the waistcoat. A large stone embedded on each shoulder with 6 tribes etched on it. That's up around 2F. Some of the ephods in the Bible were merely loincloths hung by cords. From his shoulder was hung a square linen pouch over his breast, or breastpiece. That's that 2D there you see. That's a pouch. It looks like a plate, but it's actually a pouch. And those jewels are sewed into the front of it, but there's actually a back. And inside that pouch is where Ummim and Thummim were, the holy, where they would cast lots. They reach down and pull one out. Yes or no? Urim and Thummim. Yeah, we'll get to that. And so this pouch was came down over the breast by means of 2 woven chains of pure gold. The pouch was 1.5 cubits in width, or a span. It was a half cubit in width, or a span of approximately 9 inches. Sewn into the pouch were 12 precious stones to represent the 12 tribes. They included ruby, topaz, emerald, turquoise, sapphire, diamond, jacinth, agate, amethyst, beryl, onyx, and jasper. Once again, the best of the best. These stones shall each be set in gold filigree. The Urim and Thummim were kept in the linen breastpiece over his heart. They were used for drawing lots to make decisions at time. Apparently, one represented yes and the other represented no. That's how that worked. A turban-shaped mitre on his head had the words "Set apart to the Lord" etched on the gold band. So the gold band is 2H. And the turban is 2G. A mitre is a kind of a crown. Bishops wear mitres in the Catholic Church. They usually have a point on the top of them. The high priest wore linen breeches, and that's pants. So underneath that first linen skirt, they were wearing breeches. It's like underwear. Okay. To cover their thighs and genitals lest they die. And the very simple reason is that if they walked up before the Lord and exposed their genitals, they were dead. Especially later on when we get these altars that are built up and they have to come up steps in order to get there. Pagan priests usually offered sacrifice naked from the waist down. It was part of their pagan rites to expose their genitals to God and offer their sacrifice naked, waist down. One of the many times when certain of these rules are given, it's been given because it's in juxtaposition to what the pagans did. For instance, you remember in the book of Corinthians, there's a conversation about a woman must have her head covered and a man must not cut his hair. And that's because the pagan priestesses in Corinth, there were 1,000 hierogeli. The hierogeli were temple prostitutes, male and female. And when you went to worship Aphrodite or one of the male gods there, you would go to the temple and you would pay money and you would get the services of a hierogeli and you would go have sex with that hierogeli as a sacrifice to the god. The hierogeli, the women, shaved their heads. And the men, they wore their hair real long or whatever. So when Paul says that a woman may not come in with her head uncovered, it's because, remember that the people who were joining the church at Corinth were by and large ex-pagans. It wasn't like a bunch of Jews there. These were Gentiles. And when they joined the church, it wasn't like you got a full round of explanation before you met the Lord. It took people a while to realize that many of their normal practices were pagan in nature and not welcome before the Lord. So women would come to church with their head all shaved off because that's what fashionable women did because it was part of their recognition or honor of Athena. Well, they didn't think about that once they'd come to meet the Lord. They were still wrapped up in the culture of their fashions. I mean, you hear people today talk about reading their horoscope. I mean, Christians. And the Bible strictly forbids any sort of occultic practice such as that. And yet, because our culture finds it so easy, then people will do that, not realizing they're inviting the demonic presence to come into their lives and their places of residence. So the culture very often takes a while to get out of people. In fact, one of the problems we have in our church today is that we have a syncretistic kind of a Christianity that is partially blended culture and partially the thing of God. So we have way too many things going on in our church that are actually taken from the culture rather than from the Bible. And because of that sloppiness, it's unintentional usually, but you know what happens is if you talk to people about stuff like that, they go, you're being silly. It's unintentional very often, but it's sloppy, and because of that sloppiness, we have a church full of people who are spiritually dead. Because the power of the Holy Spirit cannot come and dwell with them in a way that He wants to because of the sloppiness of their behaviors, because they're not in line with the Scriptures of God. One of the things that we see in this whole process that we've been studying about the tabernacle, the temple, and all this sort of thing, is just how exact God was about what He expected, about how we should approach Him, and in what way we should approach Him, and how what we should think about how we approach Him. With the finest and the best and the most honoring. And also, as we see here, this is one of many examples, covered. You know, what passes sometimes for women's clothes in church today is it's pretty amazing. You know, church ain't a place to strut your cleavage. You know, it's, I mean, we're all thrilled about the fact that women are made different than men, ooh la la, you know, vive la différence. But that's all fine and meant to be that way at a certain level. But when we come before the Lord, we should come before the Lord humble, as it were. And strutting is not the right verb to use of anything when you come before the Lord. So, like I said, there's these people who in Corinth were still caught up in the culture. So Paul has to write this incredible letter to Corinth saying, you know, don't pick your nose in church, don't scratch yourself in front of your ma, and all kinds of stuff that most of us would figure were, you know, reasonably understood things, but they're not. Not to these Gentiles who are coming in. They've long since lost the distinction between what they do that's pagan and what they do that's human, because they become the same. Another example of that is that issue about eating meat offered to idols. Remember that in the ancient world, all butchers were priests to somebody. So if you went down onto Caesar Street, the corner of Caesar Street and Empire Road, and there was a butcher down there, above it would say, "Our meat is offered to Athena, the best in town." And people would argue about where the best meat was offered to Apollo or Athena or, you know, Baal or whatever. They'd say, "Oh, if you want some really good burgers, you got to go down here because they got Zeus burgers down there." Because that's the way people thought. All butchers were priests, including Jewish butchers. They were Levites. And they were all animals sacrificed were offered to a god when sacrificed. So what happens is that people would go to a meal, Jews, Gentiles who become Christians, in particular Gentiles who become Christians, they would go to a dinner, and someone would say, "Man, you're going to love this steak, it was offered to Athena this afternoon. Well, there began to be an issue. Should I eat something which is offered to Athena? Because am I not participating in a pagan rite or practice? And so Paul says, look, Athena's nothing, gods are nothing, or whatever. If the Lord is giving you a freedom in your heart to ignore all of that and eat the meat, then fine, do it. You're fine. As long as you feel like the Lord's told you, it doesn't matter. Because it really doesn't, he said. But if you're with a brother who is weak in his conscience, he's not sure what's right or wrong, then don't eat the meat and scandalize your brother or lead him into sin. Now that sounds pretty weird until we talk about alcoholism today. Okay, what happens is you go to somebody's house and they go, "You got to try the Merlot. It's just the best, you know, whatever." All right. Well, you may be there with your neighborhood Baptist, And you're fine about drinking Merlot. You drink it at home, and you're not ashamed to say that you do. But if you're bringing your Baptist friend to the meeting, you may want to forego the wine so as not to scandalize your Baptist. More importantly, if you're bringing your alcoholic brother-in-law to the meeting, you definitely want to forego the wine rather than cause your weaker brother to stumble. So, we drink a wine occasionally, maybe five times a year at our household. We were raised Catholics, and so we were all raised on, you know, scotch and beer and whatever. Wine was for Episcopalians. We drank hard stuff and lots of it. So once we came to know the Lord, my parents put beer in our baby bottles when they were playing poker on Friday night, get the kids to settle down so that they could play. It was common, and if you're growing up in a German home. If you're going to a German home, you were drinking it out of the sippy cups, et cetera, et cetera. And if you grew up in an Italian home or overseas or whatever, you're drinking wine from the time you were whatever. The issue is not the beer and the wine, it's drunkenness and all that sort of thing. So when we came to know the Lord, Nancy and I sort of revisited the biblical understanding of what it is. And we basically decided that there's so many alcoholics in my family and so much trouble that it was not worth the effort. And, you know, we had no religious prohibition against it, but we didn't have much alcohol around the place. We had, as the years went on, we maybe had a little wine or something, but we never had hard stuff anymore. Now, when Ben got into his drug problem and his alcohol problem, we took everything out of the house, left it out of the house, and didn't put it back till he was dead. We had no wine in our home for 10 years, or any alcohol of any kind whatsoever. Because if you've ever lived with an alcoholic, it's just not a nice thing to do to someone to cause them to fall off the wagon and all that sort of thing. There's a hell that they live in associated with all that. So there's a lot of things that we are encouraged by God to do, and for reasons that have to do with love God or love neighbor. And the prohibition against drinking alcohol in 1 Corinthians 15, or 1 Corinthians, 2 Corinthians, where that comes in is like the prohibition on meat. It has to do with loving neighbor. It has nothing to do whether their alcohol is good or bad. Because after all, in Jesus' day, in the first century, alcohol is commonly drunk at meals. And the Jews, one of the reasons the apostles fell asleep in the Garden of Gethsemane is because that Seder meal they had is five cups that they've got to drink just for the ritual. And then there's all the other stuff, past the tankard stuff going on besides all that. I would have been lucky to be, they'd had to carry me to the garden. So these.
Wait, let me ask, since you're. I noticed that great woman, but I wondered. I never really ran into any Catholics until I went in service up north.
You want me to show my horns?
Yeah. But the first ones, they would never eat anything but fish on Friday.
Yeah.
Now that seems to be.
Well, what happened is that there was a Catholic ritual that goes back many, many centuries about not eating meat on Friday. And so Catholics, like some other religions, fasted meat on certain times, and one of those was Friday. So on Friday you could not eat meat. Fish was not considered meat. So what happens is on Friday you could eat fish. But Catholics didn't do that. In the 1960s, when Vatican II came along and they changed a whole bunch of rules, they did away with that rule on the prohibition against meat on Fridays. And people like Nancy's father, who was born and raised Catholic all of his life, he continued to not eat meat on Fridays. People like that found these rule changes very disconcerting. Frankly, didn't think they had the right to do that, because after all, Jesus didn't eat meat on Fridays, they were pretty sure. Of course, that wasn't true, but that's what they thought. So the reason there was that prohibition was because it was a Catholic law for centuries, and it got officially changed by the Vatican in the 1960s. There were rules for Lent for Catholics. There was Yeah, that's right. If you maintain the Lenten rules, then you don't eat meat during Lent. So that's why you had so many fish fries down at the church.
That was pretty good.
Fish fries and turtle soup somehow or another qualified.
Yeah.
Now, by the way, you could drink 2.5 cases of beer, but you couldn't have fish. You couldn't have meat, you know. You could have a hot dog. You couldn't have a hot dog, but you could drink a case of beer. So,
was that at Owensboro?
And smoke them if you got them. What?
Turtle soup,
yeah. They had turtle soup suppers in certain parts of Catholicism. Cincinnati had the same thing.
Mock turtle soup.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you know, just because they didn't do it on your tree doesn't mean it wasn't done everywhere. All right, let me move on here if I can. So pagan priests usually offered sacrificed naked from the waist down. Pagan worshipers often wound up naked before their gods. One of the things that you get a lot of in the culture in the last, ever since Elvis came along, okay, you got a lot of people who were complained that all of this rock and roll music and everything seemed like an orgy to them, and it reminded them of these pagan feasts. And with Elvis shaking his butt all over the place, to them it just reminded them of these kinds of prohibitions. They were featuring or focusing on exposing his genitals. Even though they were clothed at the moment, that was the emphasis. And then, of course, you got all the change in skirt lines and you got all that kind of stuff. So the people who grew up in the prior cultures, they looked at all that behavior as pagan in its style and whatever. You can't argue with a lot of it. When I see people today on television, somebody, you know, like you watch a football game and they'll have the cheerleaders, or you'll have just stuff on stage and everything. And I know they call it choreography, but I have no idea what the purpose is except for the demonstration of genitalia. That just seems to be what it's about. It's just designed to inflame and incense passions and whatever. So this is an example of what I mean by the culture infiltrating us. We've gotten so that, of course, we can turn the TV on, we see all that kind of stuff, and most of us tend to look past it or whatever. But I can't tell you how many good TV shows have been ruined for me because God said, you don't need that. You just don't need that. And that's not always having to do with dress. Some of it has to do with just the simple values in the shows.
Yeah.
So, good example of that was the show House, which we used to like a lot. But he was such a rebel and a lawless person, and you know, he broke the law and took drugs, and he justified on the basis of his extreme brilliance. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I understand what they were saying and it and all that sort of thing, but it just began to great at me that God didn't want me to honor that, so I quit watching House. Not that you need to. Smoke them if you got them. Okay? Pagan worshipers often wound up naked before their gods in preparation for sexual practices were common among pagans. When I look at a lot of what goes on today for entertainment on the stage and all that sort of thing, it very much looks like that they're preparing themselves for sexual practices. It's just how it strikes me. But then that's me. Exodus 28, verse 1. Bring near to yourself Aaron, your brother, and his sons with him, for among the sons of Israel, to minister to as priests to me. Aaron, Nadab, Abihu, Eleazar, Ithamar, Aaron's sons. So Aaron and his sons and their offspring became the priests of Israel. Nadab and Abihu don't live long because they don't take seriously what God told them to do, and they wind up getting struck dead for it, coming up shortly in an episode to be soon episode. You shall make holy garments for Aaron, for your brother, for glory and for beauty. You shall speak to all the skillful persons whom I have endowed with the spirit of wisdom, and make Aaron's garments, consecrate them that he may be ministered as priest to me. These are the garments which they shall make. Now, the garments of Aaron are different than the high priest, and I don't know that I've seen one of those in here somewhere. We'll just have to read it. Yes, that looks pretty much like it.
It's a lot simpler.
Let's read it and we'll see if that's not pretty close here. So anyways, bring your skillful people together to make these. And you know, this is where you get stuff like robes on monks and nuns. This is all this, you know, and not just Catholic monks and nuns. Lots of monks and nuns in different religions wear special robes and garments like that because they're meant to be holy before the Lord. These are the garments which they shall make: a breastpiece and an ephod and a robe and a tunic of checkered work and a turban and a sash. And they shall make holy garments for Aaron your brother and his sons, that he may minister as a priest to me. They shall take the gold and the blue and the purple and the scarlet material and the fine linen. You shall also make an ephod of gold. An ephod is like a apron. Some ephods have come down over the collar, and some are just waist have aprons. A blue and gold and scarlet material and fine twisted linen, the skillful workmen. So Aaron and his sons are appointed as high priestly family in perpetuity, as the Levitical house of Korah found out the hard way. Now in Numbers 16, there is a rebellion called Korah's Rebellion. The tribe of Reuben, which had been set aside by Jacob's will as firstborn, and resented the leadership of Moses, and felt like that after the restoration at Sinai, they should be restored to their places first. So the tribe of Reuben, some members of the tribe of Reuben, Abiram and Dathan. Dathan and Abiram. When Cecil B. DeMille made the Ten Commandments, he had to conflate some judgments. So Dathan and Abiram were actually in a different rebellion than the one that happened at that point in time. So Dathan and Abiram rose up from the tribe of Reuben to try to give them a preeminence over Moses. And then there was a group of Levites, the people of Korah, and some of his friends, but not his sons, who said, we should be the high priests, not the sons of Aaron. And so this rebellion came up, and this is the one where the ground opened up and swallowed Dathan and Abiram and his people, and fire came down and consumed Korah and his rebels. Now the sons of Korah did not take place in this rebellion, and they, even to David's day, were members in the temple creating psalms. Remember that about 19 or 20 of the psalms were written by the sons of Korah. So they didn't participate with their father, and they were spared the judgment that was on their father. God instructs them on how to make priestly garments. God empowered certain people with special skill for the task. The outfit includes robes, a tunic, an ephod, a sash, a breastplate, and a turban. So it's not what we're looking at over there. These are the same colors as the tabernacle walls, whatever. All right, it shall have two shoulder pieces joined on its two end, that it may be joined, and the skillfully woven band which is on it shall be like its workmanship of the same material, the gold and blue and purple and scarlet material, and the fine twisted linen. And you shall take two onyx stones and engrave them on them the names of the sons of Israel, six of their names on one stone and the names of the remaining six on the other stone, according to their birth. Once again, we're getting all this really tight detail on what's supposed to go on here. As a jeweler engraves the signet, you shall engrave the two stones according to the names of the sons of Israel, and you shall set them in filigree and settings of gold. You shall put the two stones on the shoulder pieces of the ephod as the stones of memorial for the sons of Israel, and Aaron shall bear their names before the Lord on his two shoulders for a memorial. And you shall make filigree settings of gold, two chains of pure gold, and you shall make them a twisted cordage work, and you shall put a cordage of chains on the filigree settings. The workmanship must be of the highest quality. Two onyx stones are worn on the shoulders of the ephod, which are engraved the names of the tribe. Six on one stone, six on the other, two chains of pure gold are also worn to connect the breastpiece to the shoulders. Alrighty, see here. You shall make a breastpiece of judgment, a work of skillful workmen, like the work of the ephod you shall make it. gold and blue and purple scarlet material and fine twisted linen you shall make it. And it shall be square and folded double, a span in length and a span in width. And you shall mount on it four rows of stones. The first row should be ruby, topaz, and emerald. This is the high priest garment he's talking about. Yeah, that's right, because this is Aaron's garment. So it's the high priest. This is what we're talking about. In fact, the thing he's talking about with the names, six names on each one is 2 F on there. This is the high priest garment he's talking about. Okay. This, but his sons wore the notch down from all that. We'll get to there. You shall mount it in four rows of stones. The first row shall be a row of ruby, topaz, and emerald. The second row of turquoise, sapphire, and diamond. Third row, jacinth, agate, and amethyst. And the fourth row of beryl, onyx, and jasper. And they shall be set in gold filigree. Now remember I did the summary first? This is the detail. That's why it seems to be redundant. The stones shall be according to the names of the sons of Israel. 12 according to their names, so shall be like the engravings of a seal. Each according to his name for the 12 tribes. You shall make on the breastpiece chains of twisted cordage worked in pure gold. And you shall make on the breastpiece two rings of gold, and shall put the two rings on the ends of the breastpiece. You shall put the two cords of gold on the two rings of the ends of the breastpiece. And you shall put the other two ends, the two cords, on the two filigree settings, and put them on the shoulder pieces of the ephod at the front of it. So you can see those chains running up there. And you shall make two rings of gold, and shall place them on the two ends of the breastpiece, on the edge of it and toward the inner side of the ephod. You shall make two rings of gold and put them on the bottom of the two shoulder pieces of the ephod on the front of it, close to the place where it is joined above the skillfully woven band of the ephod, and they shall bind the breastpiece by its rings to the rings of the ephod with blue cord that is to be made on the skillfully woven band of the ephod, and the breastpiece may not come loose from the ephod. And Aaron shall carry the names of the sons of Israel on the breastpiece of judgment, and his heart and over his heart when he enters the holy place, for a memorial before the Lord continually. And you shall put in it the breastpiece of judgment, the Urim and the Thummim, and they shall be over Aaron's heart when he goes in before the Lord. Aaron shall carry the judgment of the sons of Israel over his heart before the Lord continually. So the details of the breastpiece are given at length. It is affixed at the shoulders by two woven gold chains and hung down. Embedded in it are 12 precious stones to represent the 12 tribes. The best breastpiece is a linen pouch, and in it are kept Urim and Thummim. You shall make the robe of ephod all blue. That's the 2B down there on your picture. And there shall be an opening, its top in the middle of it. And around its opening there shall be a binding of woven work as it were the opening of a coat of mail, that it may not be torn. And you shall make on its hem pomegranates of blue and purple and scarlet material all around on the hem, and bells of gold between them. A golden bell and a pomegranate, a golden bell and a pomegranate, and all around them on the hem of the robe. And you can see that down at the bottom. And it shall be on Aaron when he ministers, and its tinkling may be heard when he enters and leaves the holy place before the Lord, that he might not die. And that's that he might not die is in reference to the idea that if he were struck down because of his sinfulness, they could get him out. They would know where he was. The robe part was made of solid blue linen. It was heavily embroidered so it would not fray. It was hemmed with alternating pomegranates and golden bells. The bells enabled the high priest to be heard while he was inside walking around, so that those outside will know that he has not been struck dead. You shall make a plate of pure gold and shall engrave on it like the engravings of the seal. Hold it to the Lord, and you shall fasten it on a blue cord, and it shall be on the turban. So that's that gold band there on the turban. And it shall be on Aaron's forehead, and Aaron shall take away the iniquity of the holy things which the sons of Israel consecrate with regard to their holy gifts. And it shall always be on his forehead, that they may be accepted before the Lord. And you shall weave the tunic of checkered work of fine linen, shall make a turban of fine linen, shall make a sash the worker of a weaver. So a pure gold headband was worn, etched with the words holy to the Lord. It hung down around the base of the turban on a blue cord. You can see the, you kind of see the cording going up there. The turban and the tunic shall both be of fine linen. The weaver shall create a woven sash or girdle. For the Aaron's sons you shall make tunics. This is the ones that are dressed down. For Aaron's sons you shall make tunics, and they shall also make sashes for them, and you shall make caps for them for glory and for beauty, and you shall put them on Aaron and your brother and his sons on with them, and you shall anoint them and ordain them and consecrate them, that they may serve me as priests. Give me that picture again, Katie. That may be more what they're talking about for Aaron's sons. That's the priest. That's what the normal priest would wear. I think that's right. So you shall make for them linen breeches to cover their bare flesh. They shall reach from the loins to the thighs. They shall be on Aaron and his sons whenever they enter the tent of meeting, or when they approach the altar to minister the holy place, so they do not incur guilt and die. It shall be a statute forever to him and his descendants after him. I got to quit, I know. Aaron's sons also wore tunics with sashes and caps. All of them wore linen breeches or pants covering their thighs and genitals so they did not offend God and die. These instructions were to be kept in perpetuity, and all of them were consecrated and anointed to their offerings, offices. So we will start with verse Exodus 29 on page 83. The 16th, we're okay on the 16th, aren't we, Nancy?
Next week, could you talk about why urine and the
yeah, we can talk about that.
In the holy place.
Well, the Urim and the Thummim were given to them by God because sometimes they would be told to make their decisions by lot.
No, but in the holy place, it looks like.
Yeah, they wore it. It was in the breast. It was in the breast piece. The
wouldn't need it in there.
It was constantly inside the breast piece.
Oh, I got it.
Yeah, that's where it lived. And besides, when Aaron and those people went into and the high priest went into the holy place, or the Holy of Holies, they were not in there asking God six questions. Should Myrtle take the exception? You know, accept the offering from the camel driver or not? That wasn't what they went in there for. Those kinds of things were. That was not what they went in there for. So those lots stayed inside the breast piece, which was a 9-inch sack, as it were, covered with jewels. Any other quick question? Yeah.
Is this the outfit they were getting all the animal stuff all over them?
No, that's the high priest robe.
So is the other outfit.
That one.
Yeah.
The one that Katie showed you. It's basically a white. It's a white tunic from top to bottom, a robe, with linen breeches underneath, a sash around the middle, and then they had a hat on their head, a baker's hat. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and the process of washing those things was very interesting, too. We'll get into that some other time when we read the book of Malachi. All right. We'll get into that sometime. All right, we got to go. Somebody pray us out.